When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Progressive's Name Your Price tool, you can find options that fit your budget. Because giving you options is the right thing to do.
Oh yeah, like when I hold the door for someone. Sure, it may be weird if I don't time it right, and they're a little too far away, and now they're running. And we're both asking ourselves, is it worth it to run instead of just, you know, letting them open their own door?
But still, it's the right thing to do. So get options based on your needs with Progressive's Name Your Price tool. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and third-party insurers. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz Podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Welcome to the Music Buzz Podcast. This is Andy Wilson, along with co-host Dane Clark. How you doing, Dane?
Hi, Andy. Doing just fine. And Dandy.
Awesome. Good, good, good. And how about you, Hugh? Hugh Syme also?
Yes, it's good to see you again, Andrew.
Yes, yes, yes. Always. Thanks for joining. Today's guest is Kevin Martin, joining us on the Music Buzz Podcast, singer of Candlebox, Les Projets, The Gracious Few, and The High Watts. Kevin's voice is amazing. It's one of those voices that sounds exactly like it does on the record in person. No joke. I've seen him many times, and it's always fantastic. Founding member of the multi-million selling platinum hard rock band Candlebox, who burst onto the scene in the early 90s with their self-titled debut album, it exploded on rock radio. As the first truly successful band on Madonna's Maverick Records, Candlebox earned their stripes and over the years have created an arsenal of memorable hard rock songs that have stood the test of time. Simple Lessons, Cover Me, Stand, Change, You, Arrow, Happy Pills, Don't You, Vexatious, Best Friend, and the top 10 hit Far Behind, and a brand new track, which we're going to talk a little bit more detailed about, Let Me Down Easy, which is really badass, by the way, Kevin. But after you listen to this podcast, personally, I encourage you to go listen to 10,000 Horses and Sometimes, two of my favorite songs by Candlebox. So without further ado, welcome to the Music Buzz Podcast, Kevin Martin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very kind.
Yeah. And
generous introduction there.
Yeah, of course.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about the beginnings of your career. So I've read up on you a little bit. So sometime between, I saw you were born in Illinois. And of course, when you guys kind of hit that first record came out in 93, you were in that Seattle scene. So kind of tell us about your first band, your beginnings in the music business, and how you got from those beginnings in Illinois to that first record that you guys came out with.
Well, I wish I could say that I begun or it began in Illinois, but I was just born there.
Okay.
I still have family and relations there and whatnot. But, I didn't really, my father was musical. My mother was musical. My older brothers and my older sister are all musical. So music was something that was a constant in our household. So it was inevitable, I think, that somebody in the family, you know, went on and did something career-wise. I mean, my father was a jazz musician, played around Chicago, played with everybody from Dizzy Gillespie to Charlie Bird Parker, you know, and from my dad. Well, my dad was born in 1922. I should preface the whole thing with that. So he's 20 years older than my mother. So my parents met in 1959 in Chicago, got married that later that year, 6 months later, okay. and were married for 42 years. He played all the woodwind and all the brass. So if somebody needed clarinet player, they'd call him. If they needed a sax player, they'd give him a call. He played everything. It was pretty impressive. And
that's very impressive.
I guess
for all us kids, you know, when you pick up your first instrument in middle school and your dad says, "Let me see that thing," and he plays it for you, you're like, "What the fuck? How do you know all this shit?" So,
that's intimidating.
It was. And he, you know, if he heard you practicing, you're like, "You fucked up that scale. Do it again," you know, sort of shit. But, so, you know, like I said, it was inevitable that one of us took it on. My first band was in San Antonio, Texas. So it was a little punk rock band. I was playing drums. That was when I was 12 years old. That's when I started. I started out as a drummer. I walked away from instruments, I think, in seventh grade and moved on to the Skins. So drums were my real passion.
Was that a Ringo-driven thing or a Buddy Rich-driven thing?
Well, to be honest with you, it was more Topper Hedden from the Clash. The Clash was my favorite band.
Great drummer.
And I always loved how Topper moved around. And what he did for the Clash, I think, was, you know, ultimately kind of why they ended up sounding the way they did. They never really sounded the same after he left. But and then, of course, I found John Bonham, and that changed everything for me. So, you know, I've been a reluctant lead singer since I was 10 years old, really.
All the good ones are reluctant, it seems.
Yeah. So my dad took a job in Seattle, and we moved up there when I was 14 years old. And right around my 19th birthday, Scott Mercado, our drummer, gave me a call and said that he had started a band with this guy named Rick Vaughn, and they needed a singer. And that he had heard me sing some, you know, at a party or something. I was like, well, I'm not a singer. I sung in school from grade 2 till my senior year, but that's just because, you know, there were girls in choir class. So it was the easiest way to meet him. But I never really thought that I was going to be a lead singer rock band. I always thought I'd be a drummer. And that band became Candlebox 2 years later, and I've been stuck with this job ever since. So
yeah, that's awesome, man.
Yeah. Seems like it's going all right.
it's done okay.
So when you took that leap and put the sticks down, I mean, who were your influences vocally at that point I mean, of course, you sound like you're going to sound like who you are, but did you have guys that you really looked up to as rock singers?
Well, Otis Redding was always my favorite rock and roll rhythm and blues singer. I got that from my mother. She used to listen to gospel and rhythm and blues when I was growing up. I can remember coming home from school and hearing, you know, Aretha Franklin or Otis or something like that.
Sure.
So Otis was really, and still is my go-to when I'm like, if I'm in the studio trying to figure out how I'm going to approach a song, not only lyrically, but melodically and rhythmically movement wise, I always go to Otis Redding and kind of pull a song from the library of his that, you know, I can attach myself to, just because he's always been so, inspirational to me and influential. And then of course, it's Steven Tyler, Robert Plant, Joe Strummer, Jello Biafra from, Dead Kennedys, just when it comes to the quickness of phrasing and stuff like that. And then contemporary wise, I'd say, you know, everybody from, what's his name? Sings for Simple Minds. Is it Jim Kerr from Simple Minds. I think he's a brilliant singer. Always loved kind of how he did things. I heard he's a real asshole, but, love his style. But contemporaries, you know, Ian Astbury, guys like that, you know, that just kind of did it their own way. And real big fan of those guys, you know, real big fan.
Not necessarily the chops, but just some of those guys just have that style. You know, Jim Kerr is an example of that. It's not like an incredible range or anything, but you know who it is when you hear it. Kind of like you do with your own voice. Very recognizable voice.
Yeah, but
thank you.
But Kevin's got the range, though, too.
Yes, he does.
Right. Before you were on here, Kevin, we were talking about just if your ears are burning, you know why, but you know, when you think of Candlebox, I think a lot of people normally out of the box are going to think, you know, hard rock. But some of your best songs, in my opinion, and where your voice really shines are the I guess you would call them ballads, but just the slower songs. And man, you know, like I mentioned, 10,000 Horses, and those songs are just incredible.
But even songs like Cover Me start off with all the capabilities of that balladeer. And then when it kicks in, suddenly you have the high E or the high C.
Yeah, it's you know, I like I said, you know, I did mention Robert Plant, and I think that, you know, for me, you know, ballads are, you know, a place where you let your voice kind of tell the story. And, you know, I think, you know, All of My Love by Led Zeppelin is, you know, one of the greatest ballads ever written. And then I've Been Loving You by these songs. It's not just about the emotion and the lyric. It's about the whole story. And songs like Sometimes, you know, I wrote that song for my ex-wife. We were not doing well. Our relationship was at a crossroads, and it was actually the song I gave her to let her know that I was going to ask her for a divorce, just because I didn't have the right words in conversation. And I've always found music has given me the freedom to express any emotion I have when I don't have those words. And I'm not a real good conversationalist or confrontationalist when it comes to relationships, you know, so you got to use those songs sometimes. But I do, you know, listen, I know what my voice is capable of. So I got to say, I do know what I'm doing in the studio when I go for those notes.
Yeah,
obviously. Yeah, man.
Yeah. Speaking of words, a lot of songwriters tend to excel in one department or the other. And then, of course, there are the people I really hate who are excellent at both. You know, like Joni Mitchell, Jackson Brown, yeah. Don, Peter Gabriel. How are you when it comes to words? You say you express yourself better with words, but when you write songs, when you approach a song, do you find the intent of the song before you develop the music?
You know, I'm music first. I let the song dictate what it is that I need to say. I've tried, you know, back in the day, I tried carrying around the lyric book and stuff. And I always found that trying to shove a square peg in a round hole for me just did not work. On this record, a new record, this song that we're going to talk about, that song was entirely inspired by, the lyrics were inspired by the music. But there are other songs on this record where I had lines that I wanted to use that I was really, really kind of proud of. Mm-hmm. That I knew I could form into a song. So I just found that song that those lyrics suited, and forced those in that square peg. But, you know, generally it's that melody gives me exactly what I need to say.
I was listening to a McCartney interview where he had explained how he would write the music and sit down and sort of allow the phonetics, abstract as they might be, come out of his mouth and certain sounds, you know, whether it's an E sound or an A sound, became his search for the right word that would sing that well.
It's exactly what I do.
Yeah.
Great.
Shifting gears a little bit, talking about the importance, and before I jump into this, Hugh, I can tell you from my experience of working with Kevin, I don't know if you remember this, Kevin, when Candlebox got back together, I feel like it was in like maybe 2007 or so, six. I was actually involved in the first show that you guys played back in St. Louis, and Puddle of Mud, I think, was on that show or something.
Yep.
But the thing that struck me at the time was, even in those days, and I think that was back in the MySpace days, it was clear to me instantly what a marketing mind you had, and still have. And, you know, not every band, certainly they think about marketing aspects, but you've always seemed like you're really hands-on with that element of it. And so as we're shifting into talking about album artwork and the importance of presentation live and stuff, and Hugh's going to get into some of that, that's kind of where we're shifting. But, you know, with you specifically, I remember that back in even in those days of you just being really hands-on with that stuff. If you want to talk about that a little bit, and then Hugh's going to jump in with some questions about the importance of that aspect.
Yeah, sure.
I actually refamiliarized myself with some of your covers. We can delve into this later, but when I saw the abstract painting from Disappearing in Airports, that's a refreshing kind of look, and then it's juxtaposed to the disturbing Harlequin, Lucy, you know, the disturbing Harlequin. I mean, some of that stuff feels like the left and right turns that I like to make in my own work, where you keep your fans interested and you don't stick to any formula. You allow each project to be its own entity. And I think that's pretty admirable. And it's clear that it comes from a band that cares about what they say visually as well as musically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Candlebox is always, you know, I've said this a million times, you know, we're never some of the parts. We've always been the whole. And, you know, I think that the, what we've done musically every single record has been a constant push on our own, you know, our own envelope, our own challenges, things that we wanted to do. With Lucy, we produced a record that was incredibly raw. We knew that we wanted to get as far away from the debut album as we could, even if it meant not selling the same amount of records. Mm-hmm. We've never, you know, the four of us were never the best of friends. We met in the band. You know, I think that, you know, Simon Cowell, you know, may have put us together back in, you know, 1991, because I only knew Scott. I didn't know Barty, didn't know Pete, and vice versa. So what made that interesting is when we make these records, when it came to the time, when it came time to produce the artwork, it's always about one of the songs on the record. And it's always about something that that we want our fans to take with them. So the Lucy is the Harlequin with the single. It was the broken glass or the broken jar that was shot with the infrared, so that it's crashing. The milk's coming out. You know, no use crying over spilt milk.
Yeah.
And then with Disappearing Airports, that was a painting that was done by a friend of mine who passed away. I had asked him to do the artwork for the record, and he died 2 weeks into painting. He had a massive heart attack. He was only 42 years old. So his sister gave me that painting to use. She said he kind of felt like this is where he wanted to go. And she said, this is one of my favorite paintings. She sent it to me. I fell in love with it. And it was the first record that I made without Pete and without Scott Mercado on drums. So it was a brand new band. It was me, Adam, Dave Cruzan, Brian Quinn, and this kid named Mike Leslie. And I wanted an album title and a painting that represented kind of that the new growth and the change in the band, and that's what that painting did. And you know, I like Into the Sun. Everybody expected us to have some sort of, you know, solar flare or some sort of, you know, kind of nebulous sort of thing. And I was like, well, no, that's not really what it's about. It's kind of about disappearing into that sun and that kind of death and rebirth sort of thing. That's why you only have the smoke, you know, sort of thing. So. I think about that stuff a lot.
Well, it's good. It's apparent that you do. As an art director and album cover artist, I am also keenly aware of the fact that sometimes being a little bit impudent and almost brave, I always use the term bravely minimal or unexpected, sometimes allows you to do a cover that stands on its own merit, and that's the tail that wags the dog. If the album's successful, suddenly the cover is brilliant despite itself, you know, doesn't mean that it's not a good cover to begin with, but I found, you know, I've taken chances, especially with the freedoms afforded to me with the band Rush. I've taken chances with their covers where we've just done slightly absurd things on the cover, not knowing going in whether they would stick or they would have any place in history. But, you know, sometimes you trust your gut, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's clear. You've got, I mean, you know, the Kids Runners in Far Behind is a brilliant little cover, you know.
I had read somewhere that, was it Ralph Steadman who did something with the first record? Is that right?
He did he did the paint, the hand-drawn logo. He also had done Cheap Trick at the same time. Warner Brothers art department had hired him to do Cheap Tricks. I did not know that. I'm a huge Hunter Thompson fan, and Ralph Steadman's. I mean, I've got tons of shit that Ralph Steadman's done over the years. But I, you know, Curse of Lono and all those books are, you know, hands down my favorite. Hunter S. Thompson. My first band was called Uncle Duke, you know, because that's how much I loved him. So the opportunity to use Ralph Steadman to do that logo was, you know, I mean, looked ridiculously expensive, but you know, made it worth it.
I didn't know he did that logo. And if you had actually cornered me and said, who do you think did this logo? I would have said Ralph Steadman or Gerald Scarfe was the other kind of English answer to, you know, with the wall and so on. There's a lot of Steadman influences there as well.
So talk to us a little bit about the new song, if you will, came out very recently, Let Me Down Easy, which I understand was co-written with Peter Cornell, brother of the late Chris Cornell. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Kevin, and the new song and the artwork behind that too?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I knew Pete, you know, limitedly, in Seattle. He was quite a few years older than me, obviously. And I think maybe 3 or 4 years older than Chris. And he was kind of the first musician of the Cornell family that was out and about Seattle playing music. And I had met him once or twice at a show, the Posey show, or, you know, or a Fastback show or something like that. But I never really got to know him. And I knew Chris far, far better, because he was, at the time, he was dating Susan Silver, who I was working for at Fluvog Shoes and Silver Management. But I had an opportunity to get to really hang out with him a couple of years ago. We did some shows in Seattle, the original band, for the celebration of the debut album's 25th anniversary. And he came to the show with his wife, who's my manager, Amy Decker. And we just sat down and started talking, and we talked for hours. And I said, I'm doing a record, and I would be honored to have a song by you. I was a huge fan of his band, Inflatable Soul. And he said, well, what are you looking for? And I said, I really want to do the next record for me. I want to be just kind of a loose rock and roll album, you know, Rust Never Sleeps, Crazy Horse vibe. No holds barred. There's not going to be any wrong or right song. It's just going to be a rock and roll record. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, let me see what I got, and I'll throw you some stuff. And he sent me this song, I don't know how many months later, on an acoustic, like, I think they're called Dobros, the metal acoustic guitars. They're aluminum. And he had a slide, and he was kind of humming some shit. And it sounded exactly how it sounds right now. I mean, it had the same energy. It had the same attitude. It had the same swampy blues vibe. It made me want to go to the crossroads and sell my soul. And that's exactly what I did. I took it to the
good
band.
Good song, said, man. Really good
thank
song.
Thank you. I said to the guys, I said, listen, we're Robert Johnson right now. And this needs to be a swampy, bluesy rock and roll track. That needs to feel like Black Rebel Motorcycle Club just cut it, because I love those guys. And I tend to do that when we're working on a song in the studio that we don't know. I'll pull from my catalog that I know, that I love, that I'm trying to influence the song with, or inspire the musicians with. And this just felt so Black Rebel to me. So
kind of a template.
Exactly. It gives them the idea of what they need to work with. But it's entirely theirs, you know, it's just, you go with it. Like with Cruisin', he did not hear this song on the drums. So he asked me to sit down behind, and that's when I did the clack, 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 you know, just that old kind of cool rock and roll thing that drummers do on the rims to give it a little bit of a go.
Yep.
And make it feel like it's train tracks, and gave me the track on the album. That drum beat is everything to this track. And of course that dirty bass line, you know, sounds like it's coming through a broken speakers and all that shit. And I sent it to Pete. I sent him the demo version, and he's like, man, this is great. This is exactly what I heard. And there we have it. You know, I fell in love with the song, you know, from the get go, and I'm just so proud of it. And the artwork, you know, the video, the lyrical video behind, the lyric video behind it is just really about those, you know, there is a real darkness in, organized religion. And there is there's a side of it that I think people, you know, turn away from that. Everybody needs to recognize. I mean, you know, you see what's going on with Falwell and all this bullshit, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic, you know, and I was an altar boy, and these are things that, you know, I've seen and heard about. And I wanted to reflect that in the song, you know, visually and lyrically, and that's what we did. But you know, you have the bridge section of the song that says, look, I want to make it, you know, don't let me down. I can get through this. And that's the, you know, that's that redemption that we all look for. So, right. I guess maybe that long short of it right there.
Kevin, if you would, obviously this, what went on in the early 90s in Seattle, and you were there, and you know, hasn't happened since, maybe never happened again. I mean, in a lot of ways, I feel like that was one of the last great musical movements from a city, right? When the record labels were still, you know, record labels as they were then. Yeah. Take us back to that time, in your world at that time. You know, what were you doing? And then what did you see? What did you experience? What's your story from being there during those years?
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, I moved there when I was 14. So that's a very young age to be thrown into a musical scene such as the Seattle scene.
Sure.
It was dark and muddy and down-tuned and loud. And I mean, it was, everything that I had kind of skipped being in Texas, you know, didn't have a lot of that. Texas at the time in the 80s was, you know, predominantly, especially San Antonio, was really punk rock. And then to move to this city where it's raining every fucking day and, you know, there's nothing to do except sit in your basement and play guitar and do drugs, you know, which at the time I was doing drugs, so it was perfect for me. it was strange, man. I my first week of school, I met two of my greatest friends to this day, John and Sarah. They took me downtown that Friday night. We saw Soundgarden play very first time, and Chris Cornell was playing drums and singing. And I was immediate like, oh, this is going to be fucking rad. That was the bubbling of that musical scene.
Sure.
Of course, you know,
what year was that? Do you remember like what year?
84.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 84.
Yeah. So you were there for all of it.
Yeah. Well, not all of it, because there was a lot of cool shit that happened in the 70s. Let's not forget.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
But there was just so much cool shit going on musically. There was a great venue called Gorilla Gardens that you could see Cabaret Voltaire come down from Canada to play at, 5440, Skinny Puppy. I mean, there was just so much music in the Northwest. And I was just so thankful to, you know, be so young to be able to experience it. And then as time progressed, you know,
I did a cover for 5440. I just had to point that out up in Vancouver.
Oh, that's great. Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, great band, you know, I loved all that shit. And, you know, there was that kind of crossbreeding that was happening between Canada and Washington as well. Vancouver, the West Coast of Canada, and Washington State musically.
Sure.
I got to see a lot of great fucking concerts and be around a lot of really talented musicians. And then I met, Andy Wood, when he was playing with Malfunction, and that was kind of what changed it for me when I realized that, there was just some really incredibly beautiful people that were making music as well. Andy was just, this bright shining fucking star in this really dark city. And of course he had his demons, you know, but, we all know about that. But when that kid popped into a fucking room, man, it just lit up, and he was everything that Freddie Mercury was and more. And that was really what changed it for me when I started thinking I could maybe do this rock and roll thing. And, you know, I might be a drummer doing it, but I might be able to do this. You know, I thought that there was a chance, cause he was the only musician that actually would sit down and talk with me when he'd pop into Flubogs about, you know, bands and shit. And then there were those untouchable musicians, you know, you didn't get close to Stone and Jeff unless you were in a band with them, you know, Green River or something like that. Mark Arm was another musician that you weren't really going to get close to unless you were into the, you know, the dirty punk rock scene that was going on in Seattle. So it had its cliques as well. It was very high school. And I don't know if any musician from there has ever maybe said that. Maybe it's just because I was younger than all of them. I was the freshman and they were the seniors, but
right.
You know, I still feel that way. I still feel that Seattle, even to this day, as old as we are, Candlebox is never going to open fucking Pearl Jam, and we're never going to open for Alice in Chains, which is just stupid. But, then came Dave Grohl, who kind of made it cool to be from, from another part of the country and moved to Seattle. And oh, that's okay. You know, Dave Grohl, cause he was in Nirvana. Well, he wasn't a Seattleite. And neither was I. Right. So, you know, but I mean, it was just weird, you know. I mean, there's that side that you can talk about that, I guess like Akron, Ohio, you can go back to that kind of movement that was happening in the Midwest. There was the cool punk rock Akron, Ohio, and then there was the stupid butt rock Akron, Ohio, you know, and every city has that sort of thing. But, you know, I was just a kid that was fortunate enough to move there because my dad took a job and I got to experience it, and it's given me this career for 30 fucking years. So I got nothing to complain about.
Right. That's awesome.
Well, I've got a question about a specific cover song that you recorded. You did a version, being a Beatles fanatic. You did a version of Lennon's from his Walls and Bridges record, Steel and Glass. Mm-hmm. And killer version of it. I love what you did. You definitely did your own thing with the melody and the way the song built and everything. But also, there's a couple of lines in there that I never heard before. It certainly wasn't on the original record, and I about just jumped out of my chair when I heard that last night. It was really cool. I mean, was that something that you added in there, or was it from a John demo? I just had to ask you that, because it's such a cool version of the song. You guys should listen to it, Stealing Glass.
Thank you. Lindy Getz, our manager at the time, he put together that Working Class Hero tribute album and asked us to do. I wanted to do Wheels. You know, I'm just sitting here watching Wheels go round and round. But Lindy's like, no, I want you to do Steel and Glass because I know that you'll go after it. And then he had one of the original demo versions that had that. I think it's like two bars, right?
Is it two bars?
Yeah. And I had never heard them before either. And so I was kind of like, well, they're on the demo. Maybe they should be on the record. And I think I threw them in because there's a bit of poignancy to them. Sure. And that song's just about, you know, him talking shit about,
Alan Klein.
Actually,
actually, it's about Alan Klein, that song.
Yeah. Everybody thinks it's about Paul McCartney, but it's about Alan. Yeah. So, and I just like, well, maybe it needs to be in there. So we did it. We did two versions. We did one that was the original without it. And we did that one. And Lindy wanted that one on the record. So
awesome. I won't say what you said in there, but you're just saying what he said. But no, it's very cool. Very nice version of that.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about your first attended concert as a fan. Do you remember what your first show was?
Yeah, Dead Kennedys, Black Flag, Butthole Surfer, San Antonio, Texas. I was 12 years old.
Nice.
Wow.
Where at?
Yeah.
What was the venue? Do you know what venue it was?
It was called the SBC Hall in San Antonio. I only remember that because we used to call it Sandy Pacina Cantina. Sandy Pacina was this girl that we went to high school with. She was, whenever anybody would have a party, she'd be the one who called the cops and told on everybody. She was like one of those kids in school, was like a hall monitor, and none of us liked her, but it was called the SBC Hall. I don't know why, but we called it Sandy Pacina Cantina. That's why we remember it. But yeah, my best friend from high school, Jeff Fernald, his older sister was friends with a cheerleader named Reagan, Reagan Barris, and Reagan and Jeff and I used to go see concerts all the time. She was a senior that nobody else would go see shows with her. And she loved punk rock music. So she would take Jeff and I all the time. She's still one of my best friends. She's actually a teacher at my high school in San Antonio, MacArthur. She's been teaching there going on 30 years now, but her son's a professional skateboarder and her other son's a professional skateboarder and filmmaker. And she used to work at this record store called Hog Wild, and she got these tickets and said, "Hey, we want to go see Dead Kennedys." I'm like, "Fuck yeah!" And I was a freshman, and she took me, and we had the best time. And it was, and years later when I toured with Henry Rollins, I did a stage dive at that show, and I hit the ground and nobody picked me up, and Henry saw that and he jumped out and pulled me back up on stage.
Oh, really?
While I was doing Damaged, and I sang it with him. And then years later, when we toured with him in Europe, I couldn't talk to him. I was so starstruck. Uh-huh. He thought I was just some asshole fucking Seattle kid. And he asked me at the last show, which was in Hamburg, "What's your problem? You know what? You've been out on the road with me for 4 weeks. You haven't said one word to me." And I was like, "Dude, I couldn't even look at him." You know, I was like, when I was 12 years old, you changed my life. You know, I had every record that you had made with Black Flag. I went to this show in San Antonio in 1982. And he goes, "That was SBC Hall." 'Cause of course he remembers all that shit, you know?
Wow.
He's like, "You're that kid." And I said, "I was the kid that didn't get up on stage or didn't get up when I did the stage dive. You pulled me back up. We did Damage together." He's like, "Wow, that's you. That's crazy." So, I'll never forget that shit.
That's awesome.
That's the first experience in my life that I was like, I can certainly understand why everybody wants to break shit, you know. When you're in that environment.
What about your first paid gig? Like, you know, you guys get booked and you actually got some money in your pocket. Tell us about that.
It was a wedding. I was playing. I was playing drums, and my buddy was a guitar player in this punk band. My band was called RIPB, which was Radical Youth Penis Brigade. And he's
classy.
He's like, "My brother's getting married and they need a band and we got to learn a bunch of cover songs." So we learned everything from Dancing with Myself. I think every song that's on the Wedding Singer soundtrack, we learned.
Right.
Moni
Moni and
all that fucking wedding shit. Yep. And I was 16. So that was my first paid gig. Yeah.
Now, obviously, you know, we talk about Candlebox cause that's, you know, but you've also been the front man for several other bands, The Gracious Few being one of them, and High Watts and other stuff. So, you know, obviously you're always exploring new opportunities, new avenues. Talk to us a little bit about that, you know, that aspect of your singing and just of being a musician?
Well, you know, I guess it's just, I've got a lot of friends out there that, you know, are band, you know, band guys and been in bands forever. And you know, the Hiawatts was really just because I Maverick Records, got terminated from that deal in 2000. Couldn't do anything with the band name Candlebox until around 2006. So the only way around that was to form a new band. So I started this band called the Hiawatts. I got signed to a record deal with, at the time the label was called Gold Circle. It was that guy from Gateway Computers that had a film division that had done My Big Fat Greek Wedding or whatever it was. And he wanted a label as well. So I got assigned to that. And then the label folded. So I got my master's back and I put it out by myself. I toured on that for a few years. And then as Candlebox reformed, I felt like I missed that camaraderie of other musicians. And so I started The Gracious View with the guys from Live in 2009. Chad and Patrick and Chad, I think, had gotten a little bit fed up with Ed Kowalczyk and asked me if I would be interested in doing something with them. So that was, you know, a labor of love record, really. I mean, it ended up costing us more than I think we'll ever make off that record. But it was a really fun record to make. It was the first time that I shared lyric writing responsibilities. The guys, I knew what they were going through with Ed because I had kind of had those emotions and moments with my former bandmates, Pete and Barty and Scott, when they all kind of quit on me in 2000 or in 1999 and, you know, stuck me with a huge fucking bill. You know, which of course now years later, we've all kind of moved past that. But, you know, I had those kinds of emotions that those guys were dealing with. And I said, you know, if you guys want to exercise some demons, you know, give me some lyrics and let's work with it. And so all three of them, you know, had plenty to say, and which is a lot of fun because there's some great songs on that record, like Honest Man, which I actually co-wrote with Jerry Harrison from Talking Heads.
Oh, cool.
Is a, you know, really, I fucking love that song. But that was, you know, just a real rock record, I think. And then Le Projet was a buddy of mine, Jeff Sasorsi, who had worked with...
How did you say that again? How did you say the band's name again? Because I screwed it up earlier, clearly.
Oh, it's French. Le Projet.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just...
I should have had Hugh say that since he's from Toronto.
Yeah.
It would sound cooler anyway.
Yeah, it just, you know, the project in French. But Morgan had been working with these kids, friends of mine from Infinite Staircase, Jeff and his brother Lenny. And they asked me if I would come out and do this song for the Hurricane Sandy victims because they were from Long Island, New York. And so I flew out there and did Dak Wild, Morgan Rose, and JD on bass, and then Lenny and Jeff. And I sang on that, which is a song called The Pride. And that ended up becoming Le Projet with Morgan, myself. The kid named Nick Cantonese, is that his name? He's a guitar player.
Not sure.
I think that was his name.
Sure.
Yeah, he was in Black Label Society for a minute, and then he did this project with us, and then we kicked him out of the band because he's a bit of a dick. And then, of course, a year later, we found out he was, you know, some sort of pedophile. But good thing he left the band. But yeah, I mean, it was weird. It was because we wrote these songs it was almost virtual, like what's going on right now with all these bands having to work in different, you know, neighborhoods and shit in different cities and states and countries. We wrote those songs for Le Projet, like I wrote two of the songs in my bedroom, then I would send those to Adam, then he would come up bass parts, and then they would send them off to Morgan, and Morgan and Lenny would kind of build the song, and then Nick would lay this part down, and then I would fly out to New Jersey with Adam, and we'd record them in the studio, and then it's really strange, but ended up coming up with I think it was like seven or eight songs out that I really, really love. We have a song called Refugee, which is a fucking relentless fucking rock song. It's one of my favorites. If you're looking for something to listen to, Refugee on YouTube by Le Projet is fucking badass. It's awesome. A monster track, man. And that's the first time I actually worked with Brian Quinn, who's now my guitar player in Candlebox. He came in and laid the solos down because Nick had left the band, and Brian became our guitar player. So it's me, Adam Curry, who's my bass player now with Candlebox, Brian Quinn, who's now my guitar player in Candlebox, Lenny Sasorsi, Jeff Sasorsi, and Morgan Rose from Seven Dust. And that's Le Projet.
So I think I read that there was 11 years that you didn't receive any record royalties from the company. Was it
13
years? Well, jeez. Wow. So tell us a little bit about that, man. Gosh, that's a beating.
Yeah, it was tough. Well, you know, I think that what had happened was Maverick was, they were in turmoil. I think they felt like maybe they're a little bit bigger than their britches. And they wanted to move like out with the old in with the new. And they felt like Freddie was kind of losing sight of, you know, where a record label should go. And I think immediately when young people start to question the success of their, seniors, or if you will, or those that have come before them that led record labels or film companies to great successes, you're always asking for trouble. Mm-hmm. And Freddie was a smart motherfucker. I mean, you know, Lionel Richie, Madonna, Michael Jackson, the height of all three artists' careers was Freddie DeMann. And we felt that tension when we were making Happy Pills. We knew that it was inevitable that we were going to leave the label. Mm-hmm. And inevitably we made the record. It did okay. I think it sold 200,000 or 300,000 copies, but it left us with an enormous debt tied to that contract. And so unfortunately we thought we were smarter than the label. We decided to break up in 2000 and it backfired and I was stuck as the key man. I tried to deliver demos, but they weren't accepting. I was doing the whole Neil Young thing with really shitty songs and, you know, just say, oh yeah, here's 10 more songs for the next record. And they were shit. You know, I knew they were shit, but I was just trying to get out of the deal. And the only way I was able to get out of the deal was I told the wrong person to go fuck themselves. And, I got terminated. And in that termination agreement, I had to agree to pay back the fourth Candlebox record, which the advance was $1 million, which I never got. I had to agree to pay that back, my quarter of that, which would have been $250,000 at my royalty rate, which was 4 points, which took 13 fucking years.
Oh, wow.
So,
wow.
That's
jeez.
That's bullshit.
Brutal.
All the other guys got to get their royalties.
Unbelievable.
But because it was basically you at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's an awful story shows you what the music business can really be like right there.
Yeah. It's jeez. Tough.
No kidding. So, Kevin, looking back on some of the live experiences, what are some shows that stick out that you were either, you know, opening for somebody or you're playing a big festival? What are those that somebody says, name two or three experiences you're playing on stage? You're just like, I can't believe we're here, you know, that kind of thing. I can't believe we're on the same, sharing the stage with this band. What are those shows for you?
Well, that would have been the first night that we started the Rush tour, which, I mean, you know, I still can't believe, you know, we toured with, you know, one of my favorite bands of all times. You know, when you mentioned that you did the album covers, I mean, I have every Rush record ever fucking made. You know, being a drummer, one of the, you know, the persons that, as I started to progress in my playing that I emulated, of course, was Neil Peart and John Bonham. So touring with those guys was a fucking dream come true. So that first show, and then of course, Madison Square Garden with them was, you know, unbelievable. Right. The Forum in Los Angeles, Woodstock 94 in front of, you know, 300,000 people, Metallica that summer of 94 touring with them, all the Henry Rollins dates, the fall tour with the Flaming Lips in 94. I mean, the list goes on and on. We did Aerosmith from, October of 98 to New Year's Eve of 98, which was, you know,
really
unbelievable. That was fucking rad. You know, I love Aerosmith.
Yeah. And that's great.
Yeah. So
what album was that? 98 you said?
Yeah. I think it was a cat. The one with the cat.
Yeah, what was it? Nine Lives or
Nine
something?
Lives, Nine Lives tour.
Yeah. Now Hugh did the album artwork for Get a Grip. That album he did.
Yeah, I was right.
Yeah, they were lovely people too. I enjoyed meeting them.
You know, I got a funny story about those guys. We did the one time I got to do a sound check. We did "Lickin' a Promise," which is one of my favorite songs ever. And because the band wasn't we were in Worcester, Massachusetts, so the band was obviously at home and they weren't coming in for sound check. But lo and behold, Steven Tyler was there. And as I was headed back to my dressing room, he's like, how you doing with your bad self? And I'm like, good, man. Good. And he's like, all right, don't even think about it. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, nobody covers Aerosmith on an Aerosmith tour. And I was like, man, I would never, ever.
That's funny, yeah, man.
And even the crew guys were like, man, we haven't heard that song in 30 fucking years, you know? I mean, it's
right.
that album rocks, and even Toys in the Attic, those two records are my favorite Aerosmith records of all time, man. And you know, when you're a musician that gets to tour with your idols and your childhood,
sure.
You know, it's bizarre, man. It's the greatest thing in the world. And one of the things I learned from all these bands was always take out bands you want to fucking watch. You know what? Take out a band you want to see on stage, a band you think people need to see. And that's what, you know, that's why every one of these bands that we talk to, like, why, you know, why'd you bring us on the road? Like, we love what you do. You know, like Neil Peart used to come to our dressing room and tell us how to switch our fucking set list around. That's fucking crazy. You know? and
that's great.
I'll never forget.
Did you take his advice?
Absolutely. He was watching us for the first five shows.
Right.
And he came into our set in Austin after our show in Austin. And he said, "Hey, listen, I've been watching guys and I think you should move these three songs around. I think the flow, because being a lyricist and a drummer, he was listening to the way the songs were flowing."
Sure.
And he was absolutely right. And the rest of that tour, which was 3 months long, we played that fucking set list every night. And it was
perfect. Awesome.
That speaks volumes, because knowing Neil as I have for 40 some years.
Yeah.
He's a pretty private guy. So for him to step outside and do that, that's a huge compliment to you guys.
Yeah. It was huge, man. I mean, we did their end of tour party and we were in Albany, New York. I think the last show was in Rochester following that one. And I got to play golf with him, 18 holes. And what an interesting, beautiful human being. I just was so sad when he passed and everything that had happened to him, him losing his daughter and his wife. You know, I knew him before that. And I never got to see him after that. I got to see Alex and Getty several times. I've been to several shows and they're still kind enough to let me come backstage. That'll never happen again. But you know, I love those guys, you know, from the bottom of my black heart. I fucking love those guys with every ounce of my being. They were the kindest, most gentle human beings.
They were and extraordinarily loyal and you know, really, really lovely people and smart, really smart about their, I mean, having my association with Neil is something I'll treasure forever. You know, I met him when I went in the studio for 2112 and Terry, their producer at the time, just said, "You want to do some playing?" And I said, "Hell yes." You know, so I got to actually, before we started delivering albums through internet and JPEGs and so on, which is now a faceless industry. I used to go to the studio and meet up with the guys and talk albums. And if it wasn't for that face-to-face, I wouldn't have been asked to play on a Rush album, you know, which was, you know, a brilliant experience. I'll miss his big words, his big heart, his big music.
Phenomenal.
Amazing guy.
Well, thank you so much for the time and for everything. Is there any other questions you guys have, Dane, Hugh?
No, not specifically. I do hope you did take notes, though, Andy, because you mentioned several songs that you've been working on, Kevin, that you're really pleased with and happy with. And at my age, I don't retain things as well as I should.
Thanks, Dane. Thank you very much.
Yeah, keep on keeping on and stay in touch, and we'll look forward to maybe connecting down the road sometime. So glad you're well as well.
Please do, and you guys as well, man. Stay safe, stay healthy. Dane, listen, if you're ever in this, you know, this crazy Los Angeles area playing with John, you know, get my information.
I will.
I'd love to come say hi, because I'm a huge fan.
That'd be fantastic. Awesome.
Right on, man.
Great stories.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself, man. Oh, yeah.
Progressive presents Adjusting to the Suburbs.
I never thought about space in my cramped apartment, but in this house, all I see is empty space. The sofa and ottoman look like tiny islands in a sea of hardwood floors. I could get two ottomans in the living room, but then I'd need another sofa. I could tell people I'm into minimalism.
Anyway, when you save with Progressive by bundling your home and auto, that's the easy part of adjusting to the suburbs. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company coverage provided in service by affiliates and third-party insurers.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.